Here we go again. Welcome back to Mostly Hairless Apes here in the Church of Science. We're stumbling along through life, and I wanted to get into capital today, the idea of a capital idea. Capital is an interesting term. We could go back to Das Kapital with Karl Barks and do all that fun stuff, but it's one of the manifestations we've been talking about here. We like to look at life through an evolutionary lens here at Mostly Hairless Apes. And we've got the three big social adaptations that create our civilizations. We have belief systems, economies, and governments. Ask a good archaeologist about their origins. But we've been doing it for thousands of years. And we've had this idea of a civilization. We have our modern global civilization, as dysfunctional as it is. And I think the real problem is a fundamental flaw within capitalism. Capital, actually, first was used, if you go back through the evolution of language, the etymology, you can find it back in Middle English, back in the Middle Ages, 1100 CE, the Common Era, AD, if you're one of them there Christian folks, and it refers to the head, the ownership. I mean, the idea of capital is having something to, some power, control over things. Just like the caput, the head in anatomy, controls a given organ or organism, the capital in an economy determines the power, the distribution of resources is how we define an economy here in the Church of Science. And our economy is mostly capitalistic, which evolved out of that whole growth in Middle Europe, which led to the colonial era and the age of imperialism, if you will. We've had empires throughout history, but we've got this global empire now, which moved away from traditional empires, which were anchored primarily in familial monarchies, and we threw those out in the 20th century as private wealth overtook it. I mean, the Industrial Revolution following the Scientific Revolution gave us this massive increase in production. I mean, that's one of the stats that doesn't get talked about a lot the last few decades. We talk about inflation and the consumer price index, but we don't talk about worker productivity. And the advent of technology with the rapid increase in technology during the Industrial Revolution actually greatly increased worker productivity. I will borrow from Carl, and talk about labor as the source of wealth, because that's what it is. I mean, if you ultimately go back to wealth, it's what you can produce, what you can generate to trade, and that you can get somebody to pay you a price for. And that ultimately goes back to labor and skill and luck, in the sense of stumbling on a new find of something. Obviously, you can use natural resources. There was a huge research paper published a few years back, lots of authors, and they basically tried to assess how much of the economy was due to natural resources. How much stuff do we actually just pull out of the earth, and the oceans, and everywhere, and the forests? And if you take that number, that they went through huge algorithms to sort this out, obviously, counting up everything they could, and they got a high and a low end estimate. And the low end estimate was at least a third. The high-end estimate pushed it up towards two-thirds of the economy, the value that gets exchanged, is based on natural resources. We can average that out to a half. So, and the other half, obviously, would be the value added from human labor, how much work we put into it. But ultimately, we're paying at least a third of our costs are going towards just the natural environment. But nobody really assesses the biggest cost. The biggest cost to our economy is the fact that we have capitalist ownership. When you think about what capital is and capitalism, and how it grew about and really expanded in the first place. Prior to the Industrial Revolution, capital would have been based on primarily biological resources. You would have owned or controlled a certain area of land, your little kingdom, your barony, your whatever title you might have held would have been part of ruling a given part of the earth. And if you were a good ruler, a benign king, people liked you and you organized the defenses of your territory and you allowed for trade and everybody grew what they could and made what they could and they traded as much as possible, as much as reasonable, and the people just survived. It was a pretty sedate lifestyle. Not a lot of mass media. People might have traveled if they could, but it would have been pretty limited. Everything would have been down in that human biological scale. And as we were going through time, we figured some things out. We started to make better tools. And people started trading stuff. And think about what's going on from capital then, going from the 1100s, 1200s in Europe. Once again, I'm an old white guy, so I tend to look at things from a European perspective, a second-generation American. And what happened in Europe during the 1100s, 1200s, 1300s? You start getting Marco Polo and trade. And, well, trade was occurring. Marco Polo was a big, big name in it. But the idea of the spice trade and the silk trades and all these caravans that would have went off. We had to deal with those tricky Muslims in the Middle East. That went through those trade routes. We had those crusades that took off. And we won't go into that religion stuff. We've done that elsewhere. But we had religious conflicts. But people were making more money. If you could trade, you could value add. You could charge somebody for saying, hey, I took my horses and mules and we went across the frickin' continent and got this stuff for you. I want a little bit of a kickback here. And people were willing to pay it for new exotic goods. Life would have been pretty boring, especially by modern standards in those Middle Ages. You would have just had local stuff. And so if anybody brought in anything foreign, that was a huge boon to the economy. That was all new resources, all new materials. Some of it would have been natural things like spices. Others would have been silks and things that people made. So we were just trading. We've always traded. We've always had an economy. It's one of the oldest adaptations for social groups that humans have had. But then it all took off. And so as we built up the scientific revolution and then the industrial revolution, we came up with all these devices and machines that could produce things. And it really exploded in the 1800s. And that was really the downfall of the monarchs, because they just got a little too greedy. And prior to the private industrialists taking over, which is where we are now, you had primarily governments being the source of money. If I was a decent economist, I could explain in more detail the transition from the basic barter economy we would have had way back in feudal times through the mercantile economies, where the governments had the heaviest hand regulating how much money was produced and what money was worth, to true capitalism, where you had independent sources of banks to generate cash and backed it, and we had these trades going on between a variety of different markets that eventually filled up the globe. I mean, the economy expanded globally before the governments have, and obviously we still don't have a world government. But that's why I'm here, because I'm an evolutionary biologist. I'm trying to look at things from that lens of evolution. And I'd like to look at where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. And I think one of the places that we're going to is hell in a handbasket. No. Oh, sure, we might have Mad Max world down the road, given our climate change issues and all sorts of things, but we've got probabilities in play that determine which way we're going to go on Earth. And I think if we examine this whole capitalist economy, we can do something a little different. We can get away from this idea that a certain ruling class, which is the residue we have from the imperial age. We've accepted over the last century plus that it's okay that certain people have inordinate amounts of wealth, huge amounts of wealth, and other people have none. Because what is capital really? Capital really is having something to trade, having some negotiating skills, or capacity. We talk about political capital. In a negotiating arena, you get into a democracy and legislators get together and they say, well, I'll vote for your bill if you vote for my bill. Or that we used to do that. We're pretty dysfunctional these days here in America. But the essence of politics in a democracy was using your political capital to say, hey, we're all in this together. We got to figure out the best compromise, and let's see what we can do with that. Nowadays, we just got more greed. That's actually the byproduct of letting capitalism become our major social system. So we get together in societies as mostly hairless apes, and we build civilizations. And we've talked about this before, the idea that a civilization is really about a belief system. You got to follow the same rules. You got to have the same standards, at least to some extent. When we have some beliefs, some things that we make up, that's all a belief is. Things that humans have made up and said, this is good, this is not so good, this is bad, this is evil. And we create these rules from it. We make our governmental rules to control how we should behave with each other. And we make our economic rules to determine how we can trade with each other. And what do we have here in America right now? Technically, we have a democracy and we have a capitalist economy. And the democracy is pretty dysfunctional. We'll agree with that. But the economy is humming along. People buy stuff and sell stuff all the time. But who makes most of the money? Ah, there's the rub. As we can get into it now, you know, the Occupy Wall Street people a few years ago weren't wrong. They were pointing out the one percenters. You know, I believe the stats right now are something in the neighborhood of 1% of the population in this country owns about 40% of the wealth. And that's a pretty dysfunctional balance right there. You know, as dysfunctional as the democracy may be, the economy is pretty dysfunctional. If you ask people what their biggest issue is, 9 times out of 10, it goes back to money. And it goes back to the economy. And who's working? How much are you working for? How do you get your resources? Can you do what you want? If we're going to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, some American ideals, we should be getting into the point of that pursuing your happiness. That's what we want. That's what we want to do with our recreational time. We want to have the liberty to do that. In order to do that, we understand we have to work. Everybody's got to work. You got to build up some capital. That's the way the game's played. Everybody gets that. But the question goes back to productivity and what's your work worth? And is the work of a financier on Wall Street sitting in a corner office with a nice view of the skyline, shuffling numbers and manipulating markets, is his labor as valuable as the guy on the assembly line, or the guy, the electrician, or the plumber, or the teacher, or the police officer, or anybody else that we pay, that we work in our economy, that we trade resources with, and how much is all that worth? And I'm here to say to the rich upper crust, go fuck yourself. That's my explicit for today. Because I think we need to change the system. That's what the communists tried to do. And that's, I know, right where you're thinking. People are going, oh, we're going to have communism. No, I like capitalism. I like the fact that I think I'm a little smarter than the average bear. I got a doctorate degree. But everybody likes to think they're a little better than average. We all live in Lake Wobegon, if you're familiar with that reference. Where all the children are above average. Most of us hold a pretty high opinion of ourselves. And we think... And if you ask them if they're being paid what they're worth, what their efforts are worth, and what their compensation is, I would bet you most people are relatively unsatisfied. Well, but there's lots of money floating around. You see salaries and prices for things, and you go, wow, there's a lot of money out there. Why don't I have more of it? You don't have more of it because the people at the top, the one percenters, are sucking up more of the money. And why are they doing that? Because they can. Any one of us gets greedy. And we all have the potential to be really greedy. We're all human. We're mostly hairless apes. If we have an access to more resources, most of us will take it. Unless we have a decent set of morals and ethics. Unless we have a value system that says, nah, it doesn't belong to me. And that's where ethics come from. That's what the ethics set for a long time. Now, I've picked on religion before, but I do have to acknowledge the belief systems of religion obviously were functional for a long time. They were functional for a long time because they made social rules that worked. They wouldn't have persisted. We wouldn't have had religious societies and civilizations for centuries and millennia if we didn't have functional rules that evolved out of those belief systems. we didn't make governments and economies that said, hey, this is how things should work, and these are the rules we're going to enforce. And that's, when you look at things like Christianity and other belief systems, the rules that they came up with, the commandments, make a lot of sense from the social perspective, from the perspective of maintaining a civilization. Don't kill anybody in your group. Don't steal their stuff. Don't even covet it. Don't even want that other stuff. Don't covet their belongings, their wives. Because women are property, right? Isn't that what some people say? That was the old perspective. But now we've created this democracy. And in reality, Darwin blew it all up in 1859. Because the whole thing about religious morals and ethics and having a belief system based on a god is that it's personal. That's why religion meshed with kings really well. Just like we could have a personal deity, you could believe in Jesus or the All-Father or whoever. And it was similar to having a king. You could have somebody in charge who made the rules. And if they were your guy, if you were a good member of the group, be it Christianity or England or whatever society and civilization you were into, if you were a member in good standing, the rules pertained to you. And nobody was going to kill you or steal your stuff because the system had your back. But you had to believe. You had to accept the king or queen as the ruler. You had to accept that this god was the one true god. And it was okay to kill other people and other groups. That's the downside of those religious belief systems and those imperial belief systems and those imperial governments. When you have those systems and you say it's all about the rulers being in charge, then if you do anything to violate the rulers, you're no longer a member in good standing of the group. You have violated rule number one. Those other rules about don't killing, those are all later rules. If memory serves from my Catholic upbringing, the first few rules are all about believing and being a good citizen relative to God. And you have to follow those rules. And that's really nice. When it works, it's a really great system as long as everybody buys in. Because everybody says, oh, I can follow that deity. I'm a Christian. Aren't you a Christian? I'm a good Muslim. Aren't you a good Muslim? I'm a good Buddhist. Whatever it is, whatever system you're in, if you're part of the group, you're part of the group, and the rules are going to protect you for the most part. But if you start denying it, and that's what Chuck did, that's what Charles Darwin did. Charles came in and said, well, wait a minute. What if there isn't any God? What if this is all just natural? What if we just have natural selection? And that's when things started to crumble. Victoria held it together in England, which is where Charles Darwin did his work, for decades. I mean, she was there for 60-some years. But she passed away in 1901. And that's when things started to really crumble, because that was the biggest empire going. England had built up a global empire. There were lots of other imperial powers. We had this age of colonialism going for 400 years. And European powers dominated most of the continent, most of the world. You know, they'd lost the colonies, but we were busy settling our own. We were doing our own little empires over here in America. We had this really weird idea that the individuals should be in charge. We had this idea of democracy, and they let us play in the wilderness over here. And we knocked out the indigenous peoples, brought over a bunch of diseases and guns, and we took over these continents here in the Americas. But we built it up into the 20th century, though, after the idea that there might not be a God and people started to question the rules, things got really messy. We had empires disintegrate. We had dictators arise. We had wealth accumulate in private hands as we built up the Industrial Revolution even more, and we discovered new technologies. But science really came to the fore, and that's really the key thing today. Because the capital idea I want to think about is science, is knowledge. Science is the best way we have to generate knowledge, and knowledge is the really core of capitalist, of wealth. When we talk about knowledge, if you know how to do something, that's when you have some value. because that's the real key. And that's why people who are in charge, I believe there was an orange parasite out there who said, I love the ignorant. The ignorant are my favorite. The uneducated. People, leaders who want to be dictators, who want to be emperors, who want to be kings, who want to be bosses, like people who know less than them, because then they can boss them around. They can tell them what to do. And if they're benevolent, do you think they're giving you good orders? And if they take care of you, then it works. But that's not usually how it works. There's usually some abuses along the way. If somebody has absolute power, they're going to get a little crazy. And we don't want to get crazy. We want to have normalcy. We'd like it to be sane. That's being civilized. We'd like a set of rules that say, hey, let's keep it normal for a while. And as we keep it normal and keep it stable, how can we do that with a capitalist economy? There's a really easy way to do it. You have to put a cap on capitalism. We don't want to get rid of capitalism. That communism thing doesn't work. You say, oh, everybody's the same. We're going to make sure we distribute everything fairly. It doesn't work because we know we're all different. That's the beauty of democracy. It shows us that we're all different people. And it's why democracy is inefficient, because we argue about stuff. But that's okay. But we shouldn't argue about the important stuff. We shouldn't argue about the fact that everybody should have a place to live and everybody should have enough to eat. We have enough capital to do that. We have plenty of capital. The problem is it mostly goes to the rich people because they're the owners, because we're still dealing with the economy that evolved under the imperial system, which is when capitalism evolved. Capitalism really took off during this last 500 years of colonialism, when people could build up excessive wealth by conquering other lands, by enslaving other people, by building factories and controlling government with their money to set wage laws and limit profits. Now, if you look at American productivity, one of the fun stats to examine is productivity, I mentioned before. Worker productivity in the last 50 years, in the last 60 years in America, has increased greatly, but it has not paralleled wealth. Yeah. One of the unfortunate myths we have in our country is that the middle class is normal. And if you look at the history of the middle class, and read some Thomas Piketty and some other sources, you'll find that the middle class is a bit of a historical aberration. That throughout the years when we've had tax records, and you go back and look through France and England and the US, and you look at those numbers, and you see that most of the money was going to the upper class, to the owner class, the people who declared ownership, all this stuff, and got up to the top of a pyramid in a given market sector. That's what we had back at the 1800s. It's no coincidence that the Gilded Age and the rise of the robber barons in America coincided with the decrease of the imperial governments. That as more private industry, as more private wealth accumulated and economic power went to individuals, that the idea of social governments started to decay. And so the old governments all got thrown out in the 20th century. And we stepped up the new governments. But what did the new governments build? They really just built up the economy. They said, oh, well, as long as the economy's growing, there's lots of money and we can do stuff. And that worked for about 20, 30 years in America. That's what everybody wants to be great again, is that really weird historical anomaly period of the 50s and 60s when we just kicked out the last empires from World War I. We kicked out the dictators who tried to step in from World War II. We got rid of those autocratic governments, and everybody said democracy is the way to go. We went from about 50 countries in the world to about 200 as all the old colonies separated out. But guess what the problem was? All the colonies, all those small countries were poor because the colonial powers had extracted a huge chunk of the wealth. And they'd set up the rules that they could maintain that wealth, that they owned it. And that's why things like repatriation and of arts and treasures and giving money back, compensation for past abuses is really offensive, because there were a lot of abuses. There were a lot of things that tore apart the world with the capitalist system. And those people still have this money. So here's the plan. Here's where we're going to start the revolution. We're going to use the commandments from the Church of Science. One of the commandments from the Church of Science is tell the truth. And what we're going to do is open up all the books. Open the books, open the books, open the books. That's going to be step number one in the revolution. Because the only reason to hide stuff is because you have a reason to hide stuff. You're ashamed of it. It's against the law. All the stuff that's going on behind the books is how people hide money. No more Seychelles, no more Panama, no more Switzerland banking industries where you get to hide all the books. I've been a drone of the state for years. And my salary's open record. We do that in a democracy. We say, hey, here's all the money. Here's where the money's going. We show accounting sheets. You can look up anybody's salary. And we know where the money's going. Well, why shouldn't we do that for any major corporation? Every big company should have to declare where they're putting their money. Which politicians are they buying? How are they spending it to get rid of pollution? How much is going to the executives? All of that should be open and fair game for everyone to critique. And we'll use social pressure to get on people. And if the 1%ers complain about it, the really rich people say, no, this is private. That's not private. It's money that's generated from labor, ultimately. You're making money because you say you own this thing where people are working. But if we step up as a democracy, if we stepped up as a unified 99% of the people and said, hey, we want the books to be open. You got to tell us where all the money's going. And then we can do the math. Then we can say, are we getting our fair share? Are we getting our share of the profits? Because any big company, if democracy is our main governing system, any big company should be run like a democracy. And the workers should have a say in where the profits are going. And yeah, management should get some money. If you've got better skills and you're organizing stuff, you should make some money. But how much? How much is enough? And what does it matter that if somebody owns something? We don't want generational wealth anymore for it to be standardized. We'd like to have enough to leave to the kids, but every generation should have to do the work. Every generation should have to make their own way. We should be able to leave something for the kids, sure. But then we should get all the kids. We should let everybody start off with good schooling and good health care. And everybody should be able to save for retirement. Everybody should have a few golden years at the end of their life. That's when we'll have a real civilization that I can applaud. And the way to get there is to keep democracy and keep capitalism. But we just need to cap capitalism. We just need to skim off the top. Because right now, there's a bunch of greedy bastards out there who get way more than their share. Nobody's worth $10 billion a year. You come up with a good idea, yeah, it could be worth millions. But it only works because all the people underneath you fill their niches and do their jobs. And they should be paid for what they're worth, for what they really contribute to those billions of dollars in profit that corporations make. And when we do that, when we open up all the books, and we're able to see where all the money's going, and nobody's able to hide anything anymore, I think we'll have a better place, a better world to live in. Because then we can yell at the right people. And we won't have to worry about yelling at who's gay or straight, or who's married, or who has kids, or who's doing what. We'll know that we're all getting paid our share if we're doing the work. And that's one way we can make a better world, hopefully. I think that's a capital idea. I'll talk to you again soon.